What's up, everybody, and welcome to the On the Runs podcast. We are coming to you live from Erica's driveway after just watching and cheering everyone on at the Boston Marathon, and I am tired. I'm a little hangry. Erica, how about you?
I'm feeling good, but I lost my voice cheering for everybody.
It's okay that you lost your voice because we don't have a new episode coming out right now. We have an OTR classic featuring Mike Beeman, who just ran his 47th straight Boston Marathon. And we saw him out there at mile 19 and he looked good and he looked strong.
I am so proud of the entire pod fam. You all looked amazing out there. We are just so proud. And if we missed you out there, we're so sorry. We were trying to track you and it was getting so difficult to juggle it.
We missed some people because the app started like saying we had 35 people on the tracker.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it was like 18 or 19. And it's like, where'd people go? And we didn't know what happened. We ran into Lori. We were so excited to see Lori because we thought like she dropped out or something because her name disappeared from the tracker. But maybe a lot of people put themselves on airplane or hidden mode before they even started the race because it said 35 people were following before it started. Then it went right to like 18, 19 people. You were so frustrated.
It was really, really annoying, but it was fun when we finally got to see everybody. So well done. Well done. It was a tough day today.
We saw almost everyone we wanted to see. I can think of two that we missed, maybe three. Amanda, we saw you. We yelled so loud, but you were in the zone. Patrick Caron like did a sub 6 minute pace the entire way. Matt Wilpers was amazing. We saw Sam Yuki and Allie G at the same time. There's a few times when all you girls and runners were coming in so close to each other. We're like, wait, here comes Sammy. Here comes Yuki. Here comes Allie. Oh, we missed Letty. Where was she? No. And then it was like Tara and Lindsay all at the same time. And luckily, we stayed all the way until Mr. 305 finally came up. I guess he looked like he was having a rough day. The heat was, it was hot out there.
It was very brutal. It was in the 70s, perfect spectating weather, but unfortunately, a little too warm for the runners.
I think I'm going to have the goggle tan, the sunglass tan. My head's going to be pretty tan.
My nose is pretty crispy right now, yeah.
But we'll be back. Okay, listen, we're going to try to be back Thursday. No promises. If we're not back Thursday, we'll be back Tuesday with a regular, like a Boston recap. We're hoping to get a few of the runners on. We're going to reach out to a few of them. We already have one locked down for next week, so we'll be back, fingers crossed, for Thursday, if Erica gets her voice back. And Boston Weeks is not over because we still got a few more weeks to talk to everyone who ran and hear how it went. I'm so excited. Jake Duncan and Justine and, oh my God, everybody. Like, who else? Who am I missing?
It's hard to remember them all. We got Beth Newts. Who else did we see? Ugh.
Jen, remember when Jen, Ashley Paulson, like who knew she was coming?
I have to look at the tracker again, provided all the names are there, but oh my gosh, the list is huge.
And I mentioned Lori, but like Maurice was with Lori. Oh, how did they finish? Because when they walked by, ran by us, they stopped, took a picture. And then it's like another 100 feet. People are stopping Maurice for photos. And it was real funny, Lori, watching you when you stopped for another photo. You're just like, okay, I'm going to stop again and take a break. And it was just,
yep. She's a very good sport. You guys did great. I'm so proud of you.
It was a lot of fun. I had a blast. I don't think I'm going to run Boston next year or for many years. I'm going to maybe get the other five. But our goal next year is to get you in the Boston Marathon.
I mean, it would be cool, but don't get my hopes up.
All right. That's the goal. Get Erica in the Boston Marathon next year. And we'll talk soon. And I'll tell you how much FOMO I had of missing the entire weekend in Boston. It was pretty bad. It was pretty bad, the FOMO. So, guys, enjoy this OTR Classic with Mike Beeman. We'll talk to you in a few days. Maybe two, maybe more. I don't know. Hopefully on Thursday.
Congratulations to all you Boston finishers. And don't forget to stretch.
Our next guest is a New Hampshire native, but currently running in the deep south of Georgia. He has run over 139,000 miles and over 2,200 races over his years. He's currently on a 45-year Boston Marathon running streak, but if you ask him what his proudest moment is, it's not Boston. We'll get to that later. Mike has many more stories to share with us, and we can't wait to hear them. Mike Beeman, welcome to On the Runs.
Well, thank you, guys. It was by chance that we met up there in Goffstown. We ended up lining up against each other, and I think you paid for Rainey and Carly's entry, which I didn't know what was going on because I was talking to Barbara French and, you know, getting reunited with folks. So, you know, they're freeloaders, so they're going to take advantage of New Hampshire. They're very grateful, and I guess they didn't understand that races in New Hampshire didn't take credit cards or debit cards or whatever. But thank you for helping them out. And then, you know, that was cool. And then, you know, Dave French made that announcement. And so that's how we kind of came to know each other.
That's right. So to get into it, the Gostown Gallop is Erica's hometown race, and mm-hmm. we'll get into that. It was my first Gallop, and I'm signing up race day registration because I wasn't sure I could do the race. And these two girls are next to me, Rainey and Carly, and I hear them saying, like, oh, here's my card. And the woman's like, we're in this small town recreational building with mm-hmm. just a wooden table. She goes, we don't take credit cards. Nope, cash or check. And I didn't have cash either, and I knew I might have to pay with a check. So I brought one check, and they're lucky I didn't write it yet. And I just said, hey, you got Venmo? I'll pay for you. So I wrote the check for the three of us. They Venmo'd me. I got their money, so they weren't freeloaders. But that was a lot of fun, and we met them right then, and we heard Rainey with her little Southern accent. Erica loved.
So cute. I was like, oh, where are you from?
Yes. So she flew up. She likes these trips that I take, and I came up by train, and I told her, I said, this is my 2-week, my rules, my life type of deal, where I was going to go up the Eastern Seaboard, and I worked my retirement vacation around the Gostown Gallop because I ran it back in the first year in 1980, I believe.
Oh, wow.
It every year until probably I left because of the small town atmosphere. Dave French, I kind of helped him get started with it as a sponsor with my store. And he's just a true gentleman. So I think I lay the claim that I think I came in every place in the top 10 except first. So I finished second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, and tenth in countless number of years. But I never won it because there was always somebody better than me running. It was a very highly competitive race.
That is true. Even nowadays, I just noticed that there are people, the shorter the shorts, the faster they are. And I'm like, oh, I can't hang this year.
And I still have the handwritten results. I think I put them on my Facebook from 1988 or 89 or 86. I can't remember. And a bunch of the people that were in that race commented on it, like Keith Kelly, a few others that ran back then. And it was cool to hear their comments on it because Dave used to finish the race, you know, timing, and then he would hand write the results and he'd have them in a packet for you right after the race. He'd make copies on one of those old mimeograph machines.
Oh, wow.
And he used to have a board. I didn't see it in the rec center nowadays, but he used to have a top 10 board from the previous like 10 years, but I guess they ran out of room or, you know, maybe they just, you know, whatever it was, but it had such tradition. And when I told him I was coming, he was so excited. And I told him I'd get a couple more runners. So Rainey's from South Georgia. She's a youngster that, you know, she runs and she's, I think, come to two races with me and both of them been New Hampshire.
Okay,
and
nice.
Came up here for that. And then Carly she used to work at my store, Total Sports, when she was in high school. And she told me that I was the one that got her to start running. I don't believe that. I think running is a self-motivated process, but mm-hmm. she used to work out with me, and she was a very hard worker, and we ended up, you know, splitting ways when I went to Georgia, and then we've kind of picked up the relationship in the last couple of years when I've come up for Boston. I saw her in October, and I saw her this April, and I says, when we come up in June, let's do the Gallop together. So that was a planned activity.
Awesome.
Note to myself, don't climb Mount Monadnock the day before doing the Gostown Gallop. I know that. That was kind of a dumb thing to do.
Did the girls do that with you too?
Oh, yes. They were. Now, the thing with them is they're young, spry, and, you know, coordinated. But when you get to be, you know, my age, you have a tendency to be kind of nervous on those rocks because it's a steep climb. And I was nervous, and I took a little bit more time than they did because I was afraid of falling down and hurting myself. but it was a great race. And I told him, I said, I might be slow on this mountain, but tomorrow I'll be in my element.
Very
nice. We just did it. We did it together because of everybody's fitness level. I felt that if I ran, I probably would have done maybe 9:30 miles. If Carly ran, she probably would have been low tens. You know, Rainey probably, but it wouldn't have been any fun because we wouldn't have been together. So if we'd stayed together, enjoyed it, and who cares what place you came in. Dave French, the only thing he cared about was the fact that I was there. And it meant a lot to see him. And I've got two new friends on the run. And, you know, when you guys go big time, you know, like Barstool Sports, we'll say that I started that.
That would be big. That would be really big. Erica and I think that was the first time we ran an entire race together.
Yeah, yeah, it was.
I made her slow down for me. A couple years ago, I would have had to slow down for her. I made her slow down for me on this one. It was a hot day.
Oh, very hot. But yeah, it's one of my favorite races. I keep going back to it. Like Eric said, it's my hometown race. I'm from Goffstown. And I moved only a little bit south, so it's still pretty close for me to keep traveling back to it every year.
And how many have you done?
I've been doing it since 2009, so I've got a streak going from then. So what's that, like 14 years, something like that? I did the virtual as well. I've got the shirt somewhere.
I had a bunch of people run this in Tifton because of the distance. It's such an odd distance. But Dave, back in the early 70s, late 70s in New England, basically race directors plotted out courses. They didn't care about the distance. Mm-hmm. So when I started running, there was nobody ever heard of a 5K or 10K a little bit, but it was mostly 10 miles, 5 miles, 7.6 miles. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a course. It was a course as opposed to a said distance. And then the 80s brought the metric system, and we went from longer races to more doable races like 5Ks and so on and so forth. So that was kind of the history back then. It was like you either ran a marathon or you didn't run nothing at all. I can remember, though, there was a lot of races that no longer exist because the race director either passed away or, you know, the town shut it down because, you know, they were taking up the whole road over the years.
So you did the first Goffstown Gallop in 1980. You helped Dave start that off, right?
Yes. He came to me because I had my store and gave him some T-shirts. And I also was employed by Converse. They were a big running shoe company back in 1980, 81, 82, 83, 84. They went bankrupt in 85 after sponsoring the 84 Olympics. So they're a big player. They made some great running shoes, but I helped them with that. And, you know, it was just neat to service or help somebody that was just a good community guy.
Very cool.
Dave walked right by Erica at that race, and I thought you two were best friends, but you just stopped right there, and you're like, hi, Dave.
Well, I've known Dave for a while. Just growing up, I was in the Parks and Rec like programs, and I just knew him growing up, and yeah, he is just a very nice guy.
He really is, and I know that I think he told me he had a heart attack a few years ago, and he looked good, I thought, and him and Barbara, I think she's retired too. So it's a good story. And like I said, we support good community people. You don't get that down here as much, those longstanding traditional races. Although I've put on a few down here that are still going, you know, to support the cross country program. We have one coming up. It's called the Run for Love. And it's fun. It's for our cross country program, which I've retired from, but you know, I may be putting on a race for my college program. In fact, I was at the college today that I'm going to be working at, and we're having orientation for all the freshmen. So it was kind of neat to go over there and get acquainted and go to my office and planning meets and so on and so on and so forth.
Well, Dave seemed really proud to have you there at the Goffstown Gallop and excited. So the school sounds awesome. Let's get into that later. But I really want to go back to the beginning of when you started running. What got you into running and how you fell in love with it?
Well, it was by chance, really. And being an older person, I was a traditional athlete when I went to high school. I went to Pinkerton Academy in Derry, and I entered Pinkerton in 1970. And when I went there, I played freshman football because I could throw a football, you know, 60 yards. And I get going, and I didn't like football. I didn't like it, and I didn't like getting hit. And so the coach was rather harsh on me, you know, because I had a lot of, I know I had a lot of potential, and, you know, he just really thought that I could be the next big quarterback at the school. So we're playing a game late in the year, and it was cold. So I got these, they weren't like Newman gloves that they have nowadays. They're like, you know, workers' gloves. I had gloves on, and I fumbled the ball like three or four times. And he screamed at me in front of the whole crowd, you know, called me some bad names so on and so forth. So we played at a venue that was not at the high school. It's like a mile away. So one of my friends says, "You going to take that?" And I says, "No, I'm not playing football anymore." So I took off my helmet, took off my cleats, and we had to wear sneakers because we were riding the bus. And I ran back to the field house, ran, got there before everybody else, showered, and just left and ran home. And I says, this running thing's pretty good, you know. So then I ended up playing basketball, playing baseball, varsity, you know, as a freshman. And so then I went out for cross country as a sophomore. I lost a lot of weight, and I grew about 5 or 6 inches between my freshman and sophomore year. So I think I made a good career choice. And the running helped me with basketball because, you know, I'm 6'2". In New Hampshire, I had a decent basketball career, even a better running career, so to speak, in track. Cross country, our teams were very good, but I was not the number one runner. I was like number 6 or 7, if that tells you anything. Mm. And so I went out of high school recruited as a basketball player, not as a runner. So I went to Merrimack College, which is in North Andover, Mass, as a basketball recruit. And I was out running one day to get in shape for the basketball season. And this guy stopped me and he says, "Do you go to this college?" And I says, "Yeah, I do." And he says, "Well, you look pretty good. So why don't you run a cross country race?" And I said, "I ran cross country in high school." And he says, "Well, college cross country is 6 miles. It's not 3 miles." And I says, "Oh, okay." So I went to my first cross country meet in college with this like yellow uniform because we're gold and navy. And our number one runner was Dave McGilvery, who's the race director for the Boston Marathon.
How about that? So
we became instant friends because for some reason I became pretty good at running. I was, he was number one and I was number two pretty much. And we ran together. Then I went into the basketball season, played the entire season, didn't run at all, came out of the basketball season, ran track. And then I did that, you know, over and over again. So by the time I was a senior in college at Merrimack and in the spring of 1977, I went down to the Boston Marathon because Dave McGilvery was running it. He says, "Mike, come down and watch me." And I says, "Great, I'll come down." And back then you could just drive up to the finish line. And I did, and I watched it. And it was a really hot day. And I remember seeing him finish, and he finished very well. He finished in like the 240s, but it was hot. So I told my friend that I came with, I said, "I will never watch this race again." I said, "I am going to qualify for this and I'm going to run it next year." Very bold, very confident. So I worked over the summer and ran and lost some weight. And I came back for the basketball season. And unbeknownst to my coach, we had a free weekend in, I think it was December. And I went down to New Jersey to the Jersey Shore Marathon. Never ran a marathon, you know. Just ran. I think the furthest I ran was like 13 miles. And I went down. And back then you had to run under 3 hours to qualify.
Okay. So you just winged it.
I just went down there and ran it and finished in under 3 hours. Qualified, wow. Came back, couldn't walk for a week. The coach is like, "What's wrong with you?" And I told him what I did. He goes, "You know, what are you doing?" You know, and to this day, I'll never forget when I ran my first Boston in April of 1978. Who did I see at the 23-mile mark smoking a cigarette? My college basketball coach, you know. So
was he there for you?
Yeah, he was. And it meant a lot to me. And I told him that later in life. And, you know, we became great friends. God rest his soul. He passed away, oh, gosh, probably about 20 years ago. He's from New Hampshire also, Frank Monahan. Great, great human being. But then, you know, since when I graduated in 1978 from Merrimack, I didn't have four other guys to play basketball with. You know, I love basketball. I played all 4 years, enjoyed it. But now it was time to do something else. And I like this running thing. And so I figured I ran Boston and I wanted to get better at it. And I just assumed that I would, you know, so I started training. And over those years, you know, during the 80s and 90s, you know, I ran some decent times. Then they lowered the standard. They lowered the qualifying time to 2 hours and 50 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
That was my qualifying time in like the mid 80s, like 81, 82. And so you really had to run fast to get in. There was very few, I don't want to be mean, but there was very few slow people running the Boston Marathon. You were either really good or you didn't get to run. So I was blessed with being able to qualify. And I didn't really think too much about it till about 1988 or 89. And somebody said, "You've run every Boston Marathon for quite a few years." And I said, "Yeah, but there's people that have run more." And all the ones I had run were under 3 hours until like 1992, I think. You know, it was kind of neat. And then the Boston Marathon brought it to my attention in 2002 or three, when I had run 25 in a row. They contacted me and said, "You know, you're one of these people that have run 25 in a row."
Wow.
And I says, "Well, great." They didn't give me anything. They didn't say, "Well, your entry's waived." They didn't say anything. They said, "You're on our streak list."
Very
and
cool.
It really wasn't published. Like it was, I'd get correspondence because we really didn't have email too much back then, but it was more of a written correspondence and they'd send out a list. Then it became pretty big, like around 2012 or so. They started, you know, putting it out there on the internet, and then they started putting in the Boston Marathon racers post-race handbook. They have a list, and now it's really like it's a spreadsheet, and I think I sent it to Eric.
I got it.
And it's kind of neat, you know, when you look at it and you go, okay, I'll take that. And they told me after my 33rd year that I didn't have to qualify anymore. You're just grandfathered in. What that means is you don't have to run a qualifying time. And they put us now in the second wave at the back. All us see a bunch of old guys that look like they're about to keel over, and we together and we start and tell each other how fast we used to be. And then, you know, and now it's more of a celebration, as you can see from my TikTok, that I just embrace the experience. I don't care. And I think our time limit for somebody like me now, I think it's 6.5 or 7 hours, where they say, "Stake your time, don't kill yourself,
and have fun."
You know, have fun. And for so many years, I ran with my head down, looking at my watch. And I think, you know, it's kind of neat to do what I did this year. Is I ran half of it, and then the second half, I just walked and I stopped wherever I wanted to and talked to people, ran a little bit. And
so you had to qualify for 33 straight years.
I did. Actually, I think I've qualified out of 45 years. I've run a qualifying time. I was trying to look it up before the show, and I think I've qualified 41 times.
Wow.
So I've run, even recently, I've run under 4 hours, you know, and now my time has gone up to, I think, 4:10 or something like that. It's, and I just, I'll do it if I feel like it, but you know, a lot of times it's, I don't want to say why, unless it's a pride thing, but if I feel good, I'll go to a flat race and cold weather and run just to say, I still can do this. But yeah, I had a lot of qualifying times, as well as a lot of the people in that same category as I am, have run some qualifying times. Some guys are still running in the mid threes, as you can see. They still are very fit. They're amazing.
So for those 33 years, what kind of training and planning ahead did he have to do? Like, what was your game plan to hit 27 and then 28 and 29 and so on?
Well, after Boston, every year you try to qualify, you try to re-qualify at the race. That's number one. You go there and you say, all right, I'm going to qualify. And if that doesn't work, you know, you go to a race, say, and like for me, my bucket, not bucket list, but my go-to race was in Jacksonville, Florida, which is pretty flat. And it's in December. And I just go down there and say, all right, I'm going to run. You know, if I need to run 350, that's what I'm going to do. I just would literally do it. And I would train for it. And it's very difficult training in the summer here. It's almost impossible. So the October 2021 Boston was the most miserable, irritable summer I've had because
that's right.
And it was awful. Like it was, I had the most miserable, you know, I'd have to go out and do a 4.5-5 hour run. And down here, I call them the Beeman points. And, the Beeman points are the combination of temperature, humidity, and dew point. And when you add those three numbers together, if they are greater than 200, it's going to be a little bit sketchy. If they're above 220, you're going to be hurting after about 10 miles. Mm. If they're above 240, you shouldn't even be out there. And most every day in the summer here, they're, like this morning, it was 248. Oof. 48. And I call it the squish factor. It's when wet so much that your shoes are squishing.
Oh my gosh.
So literally I'd have my vehicle parked at school because I used to run from school, and I would put three changes of clothes and three changes of shoes in my vehicle, and I would have to drink, I could have gallons of water. And it's hard when you come back after 10 miles and you're just totally beat in. Changing, it was hard to change. Like, yeah, I would fall over, you know, I would be, and people are like, what's he doing? You know, but I'm an expert in changing, you know, like, you know how girls, you know, they take their sports bra off underneath their t-shirt. Well, I can take my shorts off with a towel wrapped around me and listen. I've become very proficient in doing that. But yeah, it was awful. So, you know, it causes other problems too. Like you get irritation, you get blisters and so on and so on and so forth. And nobody's out doing that type of mileage in Tifton, Georgia in the summer.
The Beeman points. I remember, so I used to live in North Carolina for a few years after college. I had a truck with no air conditioning, and I remember having to bring extra shirts just for my drive. Ooh. And how sweaty I would get the back of my shirt during my drive. And I was just driving and it was miserable. Imagine running in it. And being absolutely miserable.
I think I'm going to adapt your Beeman points and start figuring out what those are around here. I wonder what it was for anchor down. Yeah,
you brought up a good point. You said Gosstown was hot. The points that day were 187.
Oh my God.
Good to know. I know it was warm, but I don't think it was very humid, right?
They were very low. I think the stats were like 80, maybe 47 humidity, 50 dew point. It was very low.
Okay.
And very cognizant of that fact. The Beeman points very seldom reach the levels they do down here in New Hampshire. Maybe for a week they might, but not that much. So I've been very aware of that. I've run in New Hampshire and in Boston where the points were less than, I think, 120. Like you just, the temperature was low, the dew points were low, and so on and so forth. But the worst weather-wise for the Boston Marathon was definitely in 2018 because we had that torrential.
I was there. I ran that year. That was my Boston year. I was just thinking about you that year, too.
No, that was a miraculous year for me because you talk about, did you ever worry the streak was going to be over? And that was the year that I thought it was going to end because about a week before, about 2 weeks before the marathon, I did something to my, I felt like it was my back, and I could barely walk.
Oh, no.
I was hurting, and I was crying, and I told the kids, I can't go, I can't go. So I went to a chiropractor, who was, his name is Ryan Burns, and he brought me in, and you know how they, I'd never been to a chiropractor because I never had back problems, and he threw me on that thing and, like, did this and jumped on me and cracked this and did this, and said, there's nothing wrong with your back. He said, it's all in your head. He goes, you got some tight IT bands, but there's nothing wrong with you. Mm. And I says, okay. It was almost like since he said it, then I was cleared. So I still had my doubts. So I go up to Boston and I'm like, am I going to make it? Am I going to make it? Of course, Erica, you know, I'm sitting in the hotel down, and I stayed right near the start before that marathon. And both of my children were there, and they were going to drive from Milford, Mass to the finish and meet me at the finish line. And it's pouring. It's thunder and lightning, pouring rain. And they go, Dad, you want to do this? And I says, well, I got to give it a shot. I got to find out. And so I had a friend at 6 miles. He was from Tifton, but he was living up in Framingham. He said, I'm going to be out there. So TJ was at the 6 mile mark, and I put these heavy sweats on, and I have like a long sleeve with my I Love Wellesley or I Love Boston College shirt on. And I see him at 6 miles. I give him the thumbs up. Well, at 10 miles, my pants are falling down and my shorts are starting to fall down.
Oh, no.
And you can only do this at the Boston Marathon because they understand. So I went over to the side of the road and I saw these two guys, and I said, guys, I need your help. And they go, what do you need, buddy? I said, lift me up and pull my pants off. I had to, one lifted me up off the ground and the other one pulled my pants off. And they go, that's all you need, buddy? And I said, that's all I need. So now I was running in shorts and the long, but I was still freezing. I had gloves on. So at 15 miles, my teeth started chattering and I was hypothermia. So I said, I can't make it. So I was going to run into Nike Wellesley and call my daughter and have her give me my credit card and change my clothes in Nike Wellesley. And because the store is right there.
Mm-hmm.
And before I could get to the store, there's a lady, you know, this is a God thing. There's a lady standing there. I said, ma'am, if you can give me your mittens, you don't know who I am. I'd be forever indebted. You'd help a runner finish this marathon. She goes, I have something better. And so I says, what's that? And she had those heat, they're like stones that you put in your gloves if you're a hunter. And she had those heat pads and she put them in my gloves. She put them down my shirt. I let her put them down my shirt. It's kind of cool. And from that point on, I was fine. Like I had no doubt in my mind that I was going to finish. And when I get up to, and you remember this, Erica, right around BC when you come down the hill. I mean, it was flooded. It was like 6 inches of water. Mm-hmm. And I was laughing. I was quacking because I knew in my mind that I was going to make it. And then when I got to Boylston Street, the best two were, I just heard my son screaming. He didn't say, go, Dad. He goes, go, B-man. Because he said, Dad, everybody yells, hey, go, Dad, or go, Mom. So he took the best selfie, took his cell phone. No wonder he works for Barstool. Took his cell phone and took a selfie with me in the background with my thumbs up. And I'll tell you, I was probably as happy to finish that Boston as anyone because it was just so unbelievable. And it just became a joke how and windy. But I'd say weather conditions, that, in my opinion, that was the worst. That was absolutely the worst time I ran. I mean, when I was younger, we had a rainstorm in 84. They called it the torrential or something, but no way was it even close to 2018. Not even close.
It's just the cold. That coupled with the cold was just something else. I remember leaving my house. I had to leave at like 4 a.m. There was snow. It was snowing. And I was like, what am I in for? But luckily, it wasn't snow in Boston, but it was still equally as miserable. Oof. Well, congratulations on finishing that. It was a feat, but to say the least.
So there's always something. And if you've run enough marathons, I think I just ran my 109th career marathon.
Wow.
There's always self-doubt. There's always something going in, no matter if you're trying to run under 2:30 or 2:40 or 3 hours. There's always something in your mind like, am I going to make the time? Am I going to make it? Did I eat too much? Did I eat not enough? Is it too hot? There's so many. And then once you get going, it's almost like, you know, it goes by so quickly, so to speak. And it's just an adventure. So, like I said, I'm very blessed and being able to do it all these years.
That's excellent.
Let's go back in time. You told me about the 1980 Boston Marathon when we spoke on the phone.
Ooh.
1980 was an interesting one because a lady by the name of Rosie Ruiz, and it's her name is spelled, well, it's Rosie, and then it's R-U-I-Z, Ruiz. And what happened in 1980, this is before chip timing, they basically kept track of people with a clipboard in almost like a tick sheet. So they would write down the number of the top men and women, probably maybe 50 deep for the, you know, checkpoints. And the checkpoints were 5, 10, 15, 20 miles. So you'd have somebody on a clipboard and they'd write down the numbers of the people that came by. But 1980, this lady, Rosie, what she did was she, wherever she was staying, she got on the subway and got out at Kenmore Square. She got right out there at, Kenmore, because that's the Green Line stop. And she got out and she had a number because she did register, but she registered as R. Ruiz, R, you know, just an initial. Mm-hmm. I don't know how she did it. I mean, the cost back then was like $20. And so she registers. I don't know how she did the qualifying. She must have falsified that, because you could basically back then you sent in a copy of your certificate. Like if you had a certificate, mm-hmm. you would, you know, put that out there. And so she got in, and so she jumps in the race at the 25 mile mark. And the way I knew she jumped in is I heard this incredibly loud, you know, applause ahead of me. I was like, what the heck is that? You know, I knew they weren't cheering for me, but she was like a half mile in front of me. I had a mile to go. Well, I almost caught her by the end, which tells me I was running a 6 minute mile. So in order for me to catch her, she had to be running a 12 minute mile, and she didn't have runner's legs. She was kind of beefy, mm-hmm. and she finishes, they put the wreath on her. And I was furious. I told my brother, I said, there's no way she finished, no way that she ran the whole thing, you know. And I made some comments. I actually made comments to the press back then because they knew I was pretty close to her. I was on Boylston Street when she was on Boylston Street, so I could see her. And sure enough, the next day they stripped her of her her crown. They figured out she cheated, and she, if you Google her name, Rosie Ruiz, I think she's still alive, but she was living in Florida, and she did it someplace else too, but really? She's had all sorts of bad things happen to her. So, you know, trouble follows Rosie, but that was an interesting Boston Marathon for me.
It's funny you mentioned that, because a few years back, I was training for my Boston. I downloaded the Boston documentary that just came out. Like, it was the one that was narrated by, I think, Matt Damon. It was like real fancy, the whole history. Yeah. And she was in it. And you said you were right behind her. I want to go back and watch that clip of that and see.
Yeah.
We can see it.
I wasn't right behind her, but I was within meters of her. You know, I could definitely, you know, if you couldn't tell who I was, but I know who I was in the Boston Globe picture. And I can't find the picture because, you know, I've got scrapbooks, and I sent Eric some pictures from the Make-A-Wish trip. But sometimes, you know, everything's newspaper clippings, and sometimes they fade and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But I definitely remember that. My sister reminded me of that up there. Yeah, it's an answer to a question. And speaking of Matt Damon, you know, he ran Boston one year, and when for a few years, and I don't get this anymore, but I had a VIP number. The VIP number, you used to be able to go into the gymnasium down in Hopkinton if you had a VIP number. And for about 12, 13 years, Dave gave me a VIP number. And I don't think that program existed after they stopped it, I believe, after the bombing. And I can't remember why, but I had that VIP number. Every once in a while, a celebrity runs the Boston Marathon. So Matt Damon ran it one year, and he was in the VIP gymnasium. I didn't bother him. One year, Sean Astin, the guy that played Rudy.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
In there. And he lined up in the race. He was like right real close to me. I was going to start saying, Rudy, Rudy. He heard it too many times. And he's not a terrible runner. He's a good athlete. And I like his movies. He's a good guy. The guy that used to play Jag, that old show Jag, I can't remember his name. He was in there one year. It's always somebody. Dan Mullen, the coach of the University of Florida, he ran it one year, and now he got fired. But So that's been a fun journey, but I don't believe they have the VIP program anymore. And frankly, I enjoyed it, but I like to be out there with all the regular people out there in the mud and the cold and the rain down there, you know, down, you know, near the start, which is just an amazing, if you really think about the logistics of it and getting people there and then shooting them off in those waves, it's really, they do an incredible job.
I agree. Yeah, totally streamlined. It's, they do a fantastic job for sure.
So because I'm able to do this on the fly, I looked it up real quick. Rosie did pass away just 3 years ago in 2019, July of 2019, just past the anniversary date. So
sorry about Rosie.
Yeah, absolutely. That's too bad. But, you know, that's a great story that you were running kind of just behind her and had all that. So since we're still on the Boston topic, I'm going to say 2018, was it your most memorable race, even though the weather, or would it be another race?
Well, I mean, as far as the weather and the self-doubt, because I was hurt at the time, you know, it probably was pretty memorable, but you never forget your first one, you know, the 1978, because I was so, so raw, so naive, you know. I didn't really, I'd never run the course before. And to, I have a picture, I think it's one of the pictures that's on my Facebook. And I mean, I wore a, it was kind of cool that day. So I wore a turtleneck with a singlet over it. And my shorts were so short, you can't see my shorts and my finish line. So it looks like I have no shorts on. And I wore, you know, back then the footwear was very, you know, in the late 70s was just, you know, starting to make strides, but the shoe to wear if you were a runner with a Nike Nylon Cortez, Nike Nylon Cortez. And to put it in perspective, those are the shoes that Forrest Gump had, the Forrest Gump shoes that he ran in the Forrest Gump. And they were like $20. Now they're leisure shoes. But the fact that I ran under 3 hours in these Nylon Cortez is absolutely amazing because they have absolutely no technical features. So that was, it's kind of cool remembering that and the innocence of it. And it was the first one. Certainly 1982 was my fastest Boston because I ran it in 2 hours, 37 minutes. I ran under 6 minute pace. By the way, until chip timing came along, you lined up according to your number. And there was no, if your number was say 1,000 and you line up, it was just every man for himself. They tried to control where you lined up, but they made an allowance. If your number was between 750 and 1,000, we'll give you 45 seconds. Well, you know, that wasn't the case. It would take 2 or 3 minutes to cross the line. I'm not criticizing them. It's just, I think some of my times might have been better because I always get kind of, you know, boxed in a little bit, especially in 82. I didn't get out very quick. It took me a while, and I ran that 6 minute pace. I was very frustrated at the start, and I know I was shooting for 6 minutes a mile, and I ran the first mile in 7:30. And I was, oh, this is awful. And then I ran the second mile in like 5:30 and then the third mile. And I said, I got to slow down. But it was probably the most evenly paced. I think my splits were 1:18:31 and 1:18:30 for the, you know, the first.
Wow.
It was just a very solid effort. And I finished pretty high in the race. I mean, I think I was top 100, but you know, the odd thing about that year is Air Florida was it's no longer a business anymore, but they decided for the 1982 Boston Marathon they were going to do a promotion, and back then promotions were like, you know, hit or miss. So they said anybody that wears an Air Florida t-shirt and we spot you, the first 50 people get round trip airfare anywhere in the United States. You could take a trip within a year. I'm all right. All right. I was running in a Converse singlet. I said, how about if I cut the Air Florida out and put it above Converse. And if you see it, do I count? They said, absolutely, absolutely. So I was the like eighth person to finish with the Air Florida thing on. And so I got a round trip ticket. I took it and I went to San Diego to visit my roommate from college, but they went out of business within a year.
Wow.
Seems like all these companies promoting the Olympics or the Boston Marathon in the 80s were going out of business right after.
Yes. I think that a lot of people, they call it the running boom, you know, as far as running really taking flight. And it did. And the shoe companies were coming out left and right, you know, and they were manufacturing, but they were over promoting their products. It caught up with them. Certainly Converse did, but they were some pretty good shoes being made. And for a while, Nike, they kind of lost their touch as far as running shoes went. And, you know, and then some other players came in, you know, like Asics and Avia came in, Reebok came in. You know, there was some really good companies, just like there are now. You know, Hoka is now a player, but the technical features of running shoes, it's changed so much. It's no wonder that we survived, because we were basically running with the boxes, you know. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of, and I would run the marathon. The year I ran really fast, I ran in the, I think the shoes I wore were like 7 ounces, which 7 ounces is about, it's just not a very heavy shoe. And you just destroyed the shoe, and afterwards you just throw it away. That's how many times you'd use it.
Oh,
it
was wow.
Absolutely amazing. And it was, I can't believe that my body went that fast for that long. I just can't believe it. But it's all relative, because after I, you know, when I slowed down, it still was tough to run eventually, oh, geez, I can't run 3 hours anymore. Then I can't run 3:10. Then I can't run 3:20. It's all relative, you know. Mm-hmm. Now I don't even care. I didn't even wear a watch this year. I just, you know, just enjoyed it. And I kept an eye on the big clock to make sure that I was going to be under 6 hours. You know, I spent a lot of time at Boston College.
Yeah, he was showing me the TikTok. Actually, I think you showed it to me when we were at the gala. Yeah. That was a lot of fun.
Hey, do you love Wellesley College?
And the idea behind that was, you know, for years you run past Wellesley College, and you know, they call it the Scream Tunnel, all women's school, and they kiss the runners as they went by. And you know, when you're trying to requalify, you have no time for that. And I don't care, you know, if you're single or married, whatever. So I really didn't pay much attention. In fact, for about 25 years, I ran on the other side of the road when I get to Wellesley. I'd run on the left-hand side because they're on the right-hand side. And after I figured out I don't have to qualify anymore, I made the shirt, I Love Wellesley College, and I let all my students sign it. And I'd stop. I got sugar and so on and so forth. Well, one year, Channel 4.
I did not know about this.
Yeah. WBZ Channel 4 stopped me. They stopped me in the middle of the race, Ron Burton. You can Google that if you want. It's called the Wellesley Scream Tunnel. And Ron Burton from the Channel 4 WBZ interviewed me during the race about, you know, Wellesley College. And so I made that shirt. And then I said, you know something? Boston College deserves some love too, because they're even louder than Wellesley. So now I carry two shirts. I wear one underneath the Boston College, and I wear the Wellesley College on top. And it's been a hit. And
you do this every year now?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. They know I'm coming.
No way. I thought this was the one time thing when you showed me the video, because the video was from this past year, right? Back in April.
Right. Right. This year I TikToked it. The previous years, I didn't TikTok it because I didn't have a phone. So it really became more of a novelty when I did the TikTok, because they just thought that was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And so they kept me there because they wanted me to recreate it with them. And uh-huh. So I did, but I said, you can't use my phone. You got to use your phone, because my phone's going to run out of juice. So I stopped. I took selfies with them because they thought that my shirt was cool and everything. And I tell you, Boston College this year, it seemed, I don't know if the school got bigger, but they were out there in full force for a couple miles. I mean, it extended all the way through Cleveland Circle and into almost, you know, to the 23-mile mark. It was just an amazing amount of Boston College kids. So, you know, you want to thank them. And if you recognize the fact that the fans are out there, I mean, most of them stand out there all day. And if you interact with them, they're going to interact with you right back at you. So I appreciate them. And it's kind of fun to be able to thank them by doing that.
That's too cool. I love it.
That is wicked cool.
But wicked. So Mike, we want to hear about your experience with the 2013 Boston Marathon. So that was the year of the bombing. Where were you? Did you finish? Give us all the details.
It's an interesting story, and I hope I don't take up too much of your time. But
we have all the time in the world for you, Mike. Don't worry about it.
It's 2012. In September of 2012 was the year that I snapped both quadricep tendons. And what happened at that point in time was I was doing, and I don't want it to come off like anti-CrossFit, but I was doing a lot of CrossFit. Mm-hmm. And it was really, you know, competing at, you know, doing those box jumps and this and that and the other thing. And I mean, in 2012, I was, what, 56 years old, and I'm winning these CrossFit competitions, you know, against younger people.
Wow.
And I was really hurting my quadriceps. I could feel it. They were hurting. And so I was out running one day on Labor Day, and I stepped in a pothole in my left foot, and I heard this loud snap. Oh. And it was a snap that I thought I broke my leg. And
oh my gosh. Happened,
my quad tendons on my left leg both snapped. Because they just were like, you know, ropes. And so when you land, you don't land like falling down. You land straight on your kneecap. And that jarring, when I landed on both knees. And my right did the same thing. And so I did the really smart thing. I tried to get up.
Oh, no.
All right. And I felt, I mean, it was as if somebody held me up with my knees bent and dropped me from 6 feet. So I bounced on my kneecaps. So I didn't have a cell phone. It was 7 o'clock in the morning. And I just waited for somebody to come along. I was sitting in the middle of the road with my legs out straight. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I snapped. I see the tendons curling up in my leg. Ugh. When I did that, somebody came along on a bicycle. I told him what I did. He thought I had a heart attack. I says, no, just call an ambulance for me. And I gave him the keys to my car. I said, well, you go. I thought he would get my car. I get in and drive home.
It's a complete stranger, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so he did, and he brought my car back. I called an ambulance. I told, you know, my, you know, the kid's mom, Marie, I told them, you know, that I was going to the hospital. I went to the hospital, and they go, what's wrong with you? You don't seem like you're hurt. And I said, just try to, you know, touch my quad tendons. And they couldn't touch them. They would put their fingers on it, and their fingers would go right to the table because there was nothing in between. It was just getting my kneecap had dropped both legs. So they said, yep, you're right. You're right. And so they said, surgery will be at noon. And they said, the doctor told me, he said, he was a visiting doctor. He said, your running days are over. And I said, that's fine. So I had the operation, but before the operation, I said, doc, I says, when you go in there, check out my kneecap, my meniscus, my ACL, all those ACLs. Mm-hmm. NCL, you know, all these things. So when I woke up, you know, he said it was successful. Your left was worse than your right, but we sewed him up. And I says, did you put some titanium in there or anything, you know, extra to, and he says, you know, your knees are in perfect shape. Everything is in perfect shape. You have very strong supporting tendons. You just frayed your quadricep tendons. And when you fell on your left leg, you snapped the right leg too. Oh. And so he says, but you'll be able to walk, you know, within a month or two or something like that. I says, that's fine. I have my running days, I figure. So then the next day, they come in and they start the rehab. And, like, they moved. All they did was move my knee. They, like, brought my knee back into my chest and put it back. And it was the most excruciating pain I've ever been in. So I said, do it again. And I said, do it again. And again. So motion brings back everything. So all the nurses were out of my room. I practiced it. I would just do it on my own and back and forth and back and forth. In order to be released from the hospital, they were going to keep me in there for like 10 days. I had to prove to them that I could get out of the bed, get into a wheelchair, and get to the bathroom. Well, I figured that out within an hour. You know, I was strong and I would hoist myself out. So I got out in 3 days and I went to rehab that Friday after the surgery. And I went in a wheelchair and the guy said, "You're going to be able to run again. In fact, you're going to be stronger if you do the rehab." But most people don't do the rehab. I says, "If you tell me to do it twice a day, I'll do it 5 times a day. So I went to rehab 3 times a week and did it on my own, you know, 10 times a day. And he was right. Within, I think I walked my first mile about maybe 6 weeks later, and it took me like 23 minutes to walk a mile. In the meantime, I had Boston coming up in 2013. Mm-hmm. So I decided that I was going to try to walk, get to the point where I could walk a half a marathon in 3 hours by February. That was my goal. And so rehab. After 4 months of rehab, January, he says, "I can't do anything with you. You're way stronger than, there's no reason for you to be here." Mm-hmm. So he released me from rehab. So I went to a half marathon down in Jacksonville in February of 2013. And I walked the first mile. Then the second mile, I walked for maybe a half a mile and jogged a half a mile and did that. And I ended up doing 2 hours and 19 minutes. And so I said to myself, you know, something, I could do this Boston thing. It's going to work.
That's very impressive.
Everybody's telling me, you know, you're going to get hurt. So just to prove to myself, I went to a marathon in March, locally in Albany, and it was called the Snickers Marathon. It's a very good race, by the way. And I ran with a couple of ladies and we did a 2-to-1 ratio, and I did it under 5 hours. Right.
Very nice.
All right. I'm good. So we go up to Boston and, my daughter, it was the first time flying. She's a junior in high school. First time flying. She's petrified of flying. So we go up there and I said, everything's going to be great. So we go up there and I have a friend who is from New Hampshire, and I taught him back in, gosh, the late 70s. And so he lives in Salem, New Hampshire, and him and his family let me stay there every year, you know, for a long time. Now they've moved, but we stayed with them. And he said to Melanie, "I will take you around the course because I know the course very well. So you're going to be able to see your dad at 4, 13, and 20, which is pretty good. And then at the finish. So, you know, Melanie goes and everybody back home's worried about me. I'm going to snap my quad tendon and so on and so forth. So I see Melanie at 4. We take pictures, selfies, you know, no TikTok, but it was her phone. So halfway, same thing. And I think I had I was on pace to run 4 hours and 40 minutes. So halfway, I'm doing great. 20 miles, get to the top of Heartbreak Hill. And that was the final picture we took, was at the top of Heartbreak Hill. And I said to her, I said, "Melanie, I'm going to walk and jog the rest of the way, but I'm going to make it. I'm going to be real conservative. I promise." So then, you know, I get into Kenmore Square. And I started getting a little emotional because I said, "God, thank you. You got me through this. I'm going to make it." And I got to the underpass. It's right before Hereford, where I'm talking about.
Yeah.
On Commonwealth Ave. And it was noisy, but I didn't know why it was. It's always noisy at Boston, but I heard noise, like it was just different, but I didn't think anything of it. And I got out of that tunnel and went to turn on Hereford. And the police literally threw those steel fences. They just closed the race. They just pushed the fences across the street so you couldn't get through. And I was like, "What are you?" You know, I said something else to, "What are you doing?" Mm-hmm. And I saw people running towards us, like running, like sprinting. And I was like, "What's going on here?" And that's when they told us that, you know, that some bombs, explosives went off at the finish line. So they're closing the race. Well, we're all like, you know, "What's going on here?" And we look it seemed like an eternity. We looked to the side of the road and everybody's just standing there. Nobody's on their cell phone because they shut down the cell phone power. They shut down the towers. So I'm in this big group. In fact, the big group, there's a picture. There's a famous picture of all these runners standing there. It was in Sports Illustrated. I'm in that group of people. Mm-hmm. So being smarter than the average bear, I said, oh, I'm going to find out what's going on. So I didn't hop the fence. I pushed the barricade so I could. I went up the parallel street to Hereford and went up to Boylston Street. I knew I wasn't going to finish, but mm-hmm. I wanted to find out what's going on. And it was just what a mess that was. It was chaos. It was people are screaming. There's just all the carnage on the side of the road, on the sidewalk. The Whiskey's place was just blasted out. There's blood. There's people down. And I didn't even know what to think. And I didn't know where my daughter was. And for some reason, I thought she was at the finish line. But I knew I reasoned with myself, she wasn't at the finish line because they weren't going to the finish line. They were going to meet me at the Copley Back Bay Hotel, which is way in back of the finish line. So mm-hmm. they wouldn't even be close. Well, then the police started yelling at us to get off Boylston Street because they heard rumors there was going to be another bomb. And it's hard to move when you're stiff, you're sore, you're cold. I had the singlet on my back. It was kind of cold that day. I was freezing. I didn't know what to do. Everybody else is like reuniting with their family and they're moving. And I'm like by myself. I couldn't get in contact with my friend Paul or Melanie because no cell phone. Mm-hmm. Cell phones didn't work. So I literally looked up in the air and I said, Lord, what do I do now? And as I'm going down Hereford, I saw these kids walking into a building and it was a frat house. And I tell everybody that if you had a bid number on that day, you were like anybody would adopt you. You could have been the biggest stranger in the world, but anybody would have taken you in. Mm-hmm. So kids, the college kids, they're MIT students. They said, come on in. And they go, you okay? And I said, well, I'm cold. And they go, do you have people here? And I said, I do, but I don't know where they are. They said, we'll take care of you. So these college kids took me in. They said, we have two things in our refrigerator. We have ketchup and we have beer. And I said, that I can't drink ketchup. So I guess the alternative is a beer. And they put a blanket on me. They gave me the nicest chair. And this young lady sat next to me with her cell phone and waited until she had cell phone service, which was over an hour. Mm-hmm. She texted my friend, Paul, and because you couldn't make calls. And he finally texted back and said, we're in Wilmington. We're in exit 38 or something like that in Wilmington. And I says, all right. And I said, I'm in Boston. They said, well, get out of Boston and, you know, come up here, which was easier said than done because everything was shut down. The city was shut down. So I ended up leaving there. They let me go. They gave me a blanket to wrap around me. And I literally walked to Beacon Street and thumbed a ride to South Station thinking I was the smartest man in the world because I could take a bus or a train up to New Hampshire, which you can, but not on this day. So I said to a police officer, I said, how do I get to Wilmington, Mass? I told him I was lost. I kind of lied. He flagged down a taxi and he said, and I guess it's called a state of emergency. He says, you will take this man to exit 38 in Wilmington right now. And the guy did. I paid him, but he gave me a ride to Wilmington, which was quite a long ride. And then mm-hmm. I got reimbursed with my daughter, but I had no idea what was going on. And to this day, I have that bib number. And mysteriously, there's three telephone numbers written on the bib number, which makes no sense because I never took the bib number off. The bib number stayed on my singlet because I got back to Paul's house and I didn't have a phone, but Melanie did. And there was literally thousands of phone calls from people in Tifton. They didn't know if I was dead, alive, because I wasn't accounted for. And so I took the shirt off and threw it in my bag and I ended up washing my I Love Boston College shirt with a bib number on. and it stayed on there for quite a while. And then when I took it off, one day I was speaking at some type of club here in Tifton, and I looked down and there's three telephone numbers on it. I don't know how they got on there, because how could you write on my stomach? I mean, I know I have abs of steel, but like, it's hard. If your bib number's on there tight enough, how do you write? So there was a lot of miraculous things. And the point Paul made to me is, what would have happened if Melanie wasn't there? Because I probably would have run about 5 minutes faster. If I had run 5 minutes faster, I would have been right in the, you know, literally. So you look at those blessings. So that's how 2013 went down for me.
That is a crazy story.
From the start of the tear in your quads, all the way to the end.
Yeah.
Well, the funny thing about it, when I got back, nobody asked me about my quads. They just wanted to know what happened with the bomb and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But what really, the thing that put people over the edge is, coming into the race, the Boston Globe did a full page in the sports section, full page article about me coming back from the quad surgery. And the reporter, Michael Vega, who covers the Red Sox, or he did, he's a very famous reporter, called me one day, and I thought it was a prank that somebody had him call me, but we talked for hours. He did a full page interview. It was like covered the sports section about me coming back. So that article was, I guess you call it, syndicated, went to a number of news sources. So a lot of people knew, because I did that, they were calling me, people from Arkansas and Nebraska were calling, "You okay? You okay?" Because somehow my name got out there from that article. And Michael Vega called me, and he was locked in his office at the Boston Globe. He was in lockdown, and he called my emergency number to make sure I was okay. What a genuine guy. He knew that I was one of those few people that came across the 40-kilometer mark. And when you come across the 40-kilometer mark, your chip registers.
Mm-hmm.
There was a little over 500 people who came across the 40K, because they closed that. They closed it, you know, that part. But there was people stuck in between that didn't cross the finish line. And I was one of those people.
Okay.
It was like we were lost. But they gave anybody credit who was over 30 kilometers. If you were over 30 kilometers, they basically took your time and they projected it. So I was, a few minutes away from finishing.
Mm-hmm.
So they projected mine at like 4:41 or something like that. So they gave us the finish. But some people were very upset because they didn't make it to 30K. And they said, "Oh, what a kick." Think people, you know, it's just one of those terrible, terrible situations mm-hmm. that we'll never forget.
Yeah, I had a friend who was a charity runner that year, and she got stopped well before, because I think she had like an 11 a.m. start. So there was no way she was going to make it, no matter how fast she went. But yeah, it was a tough day for everybody. That's wow. That is quite the story.
I thought it was a incident that was localized. And I thought, oh my, everybody back home would think, "Oh, he didn't finish. He must have got hurt." Mm-hmm. I didn't realize it was a global news. Like, you have no idea. If you're on the inside, you think, "Oh, you know, I didn't finish," and people are going to be like, "What happened to me?" I had no idea that people back home, like, they stopped. Like, people told me they were in baseball practice and they stopped baseball practice, you know, to wait and see if they heard from me. My Facebook, you can't go back now. It used to be able to go back on your timeline. My timeline on that day was so eerie. It went from Beeman's hit halfway, Beeman's hit, you know, 25K, Beeman's hit 30K. People would put on my timeline, you know, "He's doing great. He's doing great. Go Beeman, da 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 da." And then there was a interaction that said, "Boston Marathon interrupted by two bombs at the finish line." And all of a sudden, there was this thread of, "Has anybody heard from Beeman? Is Beeman okay? What happened to Melanie? Is anybody heard from Beeman?" And it went on for about an hour. And it's really eerie to look at that, what people's thoughts were. And it was kind of, you know, it was kind of, when I look back at it, I didn't look at it for a long time because it was just buried.
Mm-hmm.
I left to go to the start at Hopkinton. My Facebook, that was the only social media I had back then. I didn't have TikTok. I cleared out my notifications. When I get back to Paul's house in Salem, New Hampshire, I had over 1,200 notifications between friend requests, messages, and timeline. Over 1,200.
Wow.
And there was over 400 messages, and most of the messages were from people I didn't know. There were people like news stations and stuff like that. And I actually didn't. I think I spoke to two, but I really told them, I says, I have no idea. They were asking me questions. I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like I couldn't, they were looking for answers that I couldn't solve because I just didn't know what actually happened. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how close I was until I went back and figured it all out. So it was one of those surreal situations. So yeah, that was an event.
Mm-hmm. That just goes to show how much of an impact you have on your community, like the running community. People love and care about you and just wanted to make sure you were okay.
Yeah, it was very sweet. And, you know, the people even, you know, because I'm from Derry in Londonderry, you know, people from there, they told me, you were the first person, when I think of the Boston Marathon, I think of you, you know, and that's kids I've taught that you don't realize that that's what they equate you with, you mm-hmm. know, is Boston Marathon, which is kind of cool, you know, because I don't feel that way, you know, because I've digressed so much. I consider myself a participant, and it's neat to be able to see that appreciation for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to get to what's maybe one of your most proudest running moments, but I want to ask you one more Boston question, and that is, what is the goal? What is the end game with the streak?
I think God will tell me. I think that, you know, I don't want to be in a position where I disgrace the Boston Marathon. Like, I think the time element of, I think it's, I want to say it's 6.5 or 7 hours. If I'm not able to do that, I don't think I belong there. It's because there would have to be something physically wrong with me. So I just take it year to year and thank the good Lord for it and give him the credit, because that's my belief. I don't think that anybody does it alone. I think I have a lot of help from him and people like you. I mean, you're the heroes because of what you're doing for the running community in New Hampshire. You're taking a love in your, I mean, what you're doing is work, and you're spreading it to other people. You might interest somebody or more than one person in running, and that's my passion. So I appreciate what everybody does for me, you know, as far as running goes. Even the people that run and walk with me now, that I seem to attract the female population into my training program, because it has nothing to do with me. It has to do with the fact that women have a tendency to listen more. This is very true. You know, I do the Jeff Galloway on a Mike Beeman level, and I adjust according to the heat and how I feel. So I might go out and do a 1-to-1, a 2-to-1, a 5-to-1, whatever I feel. And sometimes I run straight out. And if you're a beginning runner, or even sometimes an experienced runner, it that walking break, I've learned in my age, my posture gets better when I take a break and walk, because I have a tendency, even when I was fast, I would have a tendency to hunch when I get tired. You know, shoulders drop, and that does a job on your quadriceps and your knees. So I'm very adamant about straightening up and walking, you know, and, you know, I ran a 3:45 marathon in Jacksonville doing a two-minute run, 1-minute walk. I mean, that's pretty quick for a marathon with that ratio. So, you know, I think that, you know, as long as I'm able to do it in the allotted time, I'm not out to finish, you know, be number one or have the most, but it's nice to, when it's all over, say, all right, you know, I cracked the top 10, or now I guess I'm in the top 5, you know. Johnny Kelly, the elder, he ran, I think he started 62 of them. He finished 59, but he won, I think, 3 of them, 2 or 3 of them, right?
Something like
Bill
that.
Rogers. Yeah, Bill Rogers. I saw Billy down at Boston. I usually see him every year, and we always go back. Bill Rogers and I were friends as businessmen before we were friends as runners. That's the funny thing. He had a running store, and we used to exchange shoes, him and I. So we're good friends because of that. But I was talking to him at Boston, and he says to me, he goes, Mike, he says, what number is this for you? And I says, 45. He goes, oh my gosh, that's incredible. You're amazing. I said, Bill, you won four of them. And he goes, yeah, but I only ran 17 of them. And he shook his head, you know, probably the greatest runner in the world in the late 70s and early 80s. And he's saying that I'm amazing. I mean, that's what the running community, we support each other. So it's kind of a neat thing. I'm in awe of Dave McGilvery that runs it after the race is over, you know, stuff like that. Everybody has a story, I guess.
All right. Last Boston question, because I just thought of it. You said in the 70s, you'll never watch a Boston marathon again. When the streak is over, will you go and watch and cheer on?
If you know, somebody's running that maybe I'm friendly with, I guess you kind of called me out on that one. I think the aura and the mystique and the just, if you're part of that whole Boston Marathon situation, to see the finish, I might get a little sad because knowing that I came down Boylston so many years, and Erica knows this, when you turn the corner from Hereford to Boylston, I don't know, there's not a greater feeling, is there?
Hugged a lot of sweaty people today.